My guest Chinua Achebe is one of Africa's most acclaimed and widely read novelists. In 1968, he wrote, "It is clear to me that an African creative writer who tries to avoid the big social and political issues of contemporary Africa will end up being completely irrelevant, like the absurd man in the proverb who leaves his burning house to pursue a rat fleeing from the flames." Achebe has tackled those big issues in his own fiction. His 1958 novel, Things Fall Apart, is about his country's early encounters with Christianity and colonialism. His new book, Anthills of the Savannah, is about the failure of a post-colonial government in a fictitious African country. The leader who begins as an idealist turns into a tyrant. Anthills of the Savannah is Achebe's first novel in over 20 years. Chinua Achebe was born in East Nigeria in 1930 at the crossroads of two cultures, traditional Igbo and Christianity. This year, he's a visiting professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Welcome to Fresh Air. One of the characters in your new novel says that writers shouldn't stop at documenting social problems, they should give prescriptions. And another character, who is a writer, says in response, "Writers don't give prescriptions, they give headaches." Is that how you feel too?
Yes. I think that's one of the few instances in the novel where you can identify what the characters are saying with the way I feel, and that comes from the pressure which is mounting on us on
writers,
on creative writers. Yes, in especially in post-colonial areas of the world, to tell their people what they should do to be saved, you see, and to tell them not in the way that great stories have told, but in specific, detailed, almost ideological ways. And I think it is the duty of artists to resist. And this is why the artist and the poet in the novel is resisting. And of course, exaggerating, because this is part of the whole business of teaching, the whole business of prophecy is in fact to exaggerate. And so when he says it's my duty to give headaches, you know, this fixes it in the mind, which is why we use extreme images like that.
Are there headaches you're trying to give with your new novel?
Yes. I definitely. You see, one of the most common features of post-colonial Africa is a sense of disenchantment, a sense of despair. We had come to independence not so long ago, thinking, as Nkrumah said, you know, "Seek ye first the political kingdom and everything else will be added unto you." And it seemed reasonable as recently as 1956, 57, 60 to say that. And our experience in this, the last 25 years, is that getting the political kingdom, so-called, does not solve all our problems. In fact, they create some new ones. And this is where we are today. And so to explore and expose this situation is not going to be pleasing, especially to those who are running the show.
Well, I think your book in part tries to answer the question, how can a government start off idealistically and end up ideologically and despotically? Was it a shock to you that could happen when you saw post-colonial black governments in Africa becoming less democratic than the ideal?
Yes, but the disappointment is not simply in the area of democracy, because this is the way the West generally attempts to knock our effort, you see. Lack of democracy is part of it, but it's not the whole story. Actually, I would even go further and say that it is, in retrospect, it is not surprising that democracy should fail in post-colonial Africa, because colonial Africa was not trained in democracy. This is one of the fallacies that is often projected. Oh, we taught these people the Westminster model of democracy, or we taught them this and we taught them that, and look what they're doing. But the colonial regime was not a democratic regime. It was a totalitarian regime in every sense of the word. And so there was no reason to expect that anybody emerging out of colonial rule would have absorbed the principles of democracy. So this is not the source of my disenchantment. The source of the disenchantment is that now we know. So what are we doing about it? You know, we've been independent now for 25 years. So what are we doing about it? What are the signs that we understand now some of the sources of our problem, and we're going to tackle them seriously?
My guest is Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe in his new novel is titled Anthills of the Savannah. Now, your novel is really told from the perspective of two people who work closely with the leader of this fictional African country. Now, after your country, Nigeria, got its independence from England, in 1960, you became one of the heads of Nigerian Radio.
Yes.
Which was a government-sponsored radio. So that put you into a position of being close to the government. Did you have much freedom in that position, and was that a disillusioning experience for you, or was that a positive experience for you?
Well, it was both. It was both. Yeah, initially, there was this heady atmosphere, the feeling that we had arrived, that a new history was being made, that we were part of it, which had come with the last stages of the nationalist protest. And we were put in positions of authority. You know, I was under 30, you know, and head of our external broadcasting service. And to begin with, we didn't have too many problems. But within a few years, you know, power does this. You know, you were now dealing with local controllers of power, the ministers of information and the prime minister, who wanted to get more and more input into what was said. And the idea of a free, autonomous corporation immediately began to seem very, very difficult to maintain. I did, of course, struggle very hard to maintain my sense of independence, not necessarily because I was anything special, but I think I understood some of the dangers and avoided them. I knew, for instance, that I must not get too close to the politicians. It was very attractive to be hanging around them, to be eating in their homes. And once you got into that position, the minister then didn't need to put anything on paper. He would simply hint at it and you would go and do it.
You know, one of the characters in your book makes the observation that the stereotypes that the white rulers used to have of blacks in Africa, the haves now have of the have-nots in Africa. And the character says, This is what they always used to say, what the colonists used to say about the Africans. You see, they're not in the least like ourselves. They don't need and they can't use luxuries that you and I must have. They have the animal capacity to endure the pain of, shall we say, domestication. Mm. Is that your observation, too, that it's now a kind of haves versus have-nots type
yes,
of
yes.
affair?
Yes, yes. This is a class problem being put in this kind of dramatic way. It is really the class system, which develops very quickly, too.
Well, you're kind of in the have type of position.
Yes, I am there. Yes, this is what makes it...
So it's a real dilemma about how to behave in a way.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You know, this is your class. You know, you're talking about yourself in some ways. And you do what you can, you know, to minimize this tragedy as far as you can. But you know that it's not really something that one person can do. You frighten your friends and tell them, you know, tell them stories of great danger. Tell them stories of coups that are likely to come, military coups and so on. And in order to save yourself and save your friends. But it's something now we know that it's something that probably requires more fundamental restructuring, that one person cannot do it.
You didn't write a novel for around 20, 22
years.
Yes,
thereabouts.
You had said somewhere that the Biafran War, which was a struggle from the Igbo people to secede from Nigeria, was largely responsible, or partly responsible, for that hiatus. Why was that such a watershed experience for you?
Well, it was. It was a traumatic experience because of what happened. It's not just that one section of Nigeria wanted to secede, but the price that was paid to put down this attempt, the number of young people who were sacrificed in a very, very bloody civil war, one of the worst in modern history. And at the end of the day, you ask yourself, what do you say to these people who were sent to their death? We have this sense of responsibility for the dead. And in my traditional society, the person who survives in this kind of situation carries a huge burden of guilt for the rest of their lives, you see. And this is really what I'm saying, and that any society who allows this to happen has this this problem of a huge burden of guilt. And for me, the history of Africa, which is really the base of my fiction, my fiction is an attempt to recreate the modern African history in fictional terms. And I have taken the key moments, as you said, as when we began. First, the first confrontation between Europe and Africa. Then the next generation and the next generation. And the book I wrote in 1966 ended with a military coup, which, as it happened, coincided immediately with a similar event in Nigeria. And so this last book was taking a new position in this history, the position of Africa under military control, what we're doing with it. And so when I stopped writing fiction in 66, it was really an attempt to examine all this, what I had understood this history to be saying. How do you account for this bloodletting on this massive scale? How do you explain the hatred that allowed one section of the community to cut open pregnant women? From what wells of hatred can this kind of thing spring? You see, now coming to terms with that kind of experience really needed a lot of time for me.
You said earlier that that you wanted to deal with the disenchantment that many Africans are feeling now, and the question is, how do you respond to military rule? What kind of struggle is the appropriate struggle? There's a parable that you tell in your novel about the turtle and the leopard, the tortoise and the leopard.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to tell that parable and see how it relates to you.
Well, it's a very striking, very short story. The leopard meets the tortoise on a lonely stretch of road. The leopard has been trying to catch the tortoise for a long time. The tortoise is a trickster, and so obviously has been escaping. And then on this day, the leopard finally catches up with him and says, "Aha, now I've got you, prepare to die." And tortoise says to leopard, "Can I ask you one last favor?" And the leopard says, "Yes, why not?" And tortoise says, "Give me a short time to prepare myself for death." And leopard looked around and said, "I don't see why not. Yes, go ahead." But then instead of standing still and thinking, as the leopard had expected, the tortoise began to to dig and scatter sand, you know, all over the road, you know, and throwing sand in all directions with his hands and feet. And the leopard says, what's going on? Why are you doing that? And the tortoise says, I'm doing this because after I am dead, I want anyone passing by this spot and seeing all this sign of struggle on the road to say a man and his match struggled here. And the moral of this is the importance of struggle, that we cannot guarantee, no one is going to guarantee us the outcome. Nobody is going to say, if you struggle, you will succeed. It will be too simple. But even if we are not sure how it is going to end, what success will attend our enterprise, we still have this obligation to struggle.
Okay, my guest is novelist Chinua Achebe, who is a native Nigerian, and this year is a visiting professor of English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. His new novel is called Antels of the Savannah. We're going to talk more about his writing and about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Chinua Achebe is my guest. You've described yourself as growing up at the crossroads of two cultures, Christian and traditional Igbo culture in East Nigeria, where you grew up. And you said that you grew up at a time when the two were really separated, very distinctly, and your parents were devout Christians. What were the ways in which those two cultures were separated when you were young? What were some of the distinctions in the way the people in the two cultures lived?
Well, you see, it's a matter of the religion. My parents had accepted and been converted to Christianity, and so they abandoned the traditional modes of worship. They no longer believed in the traditional gods. They went to church. My father was actually a teacher and evangelist, so he traveled around and was spreading the gospel. And so we grew up in my family, and the same would apply to other families, Christian families, having a totally different way of living from our relations who stayed worshipping the gods of the village, the earth goddess, the god of yams, and so on, the god of thunder.
Were you told to see them as heathen?
Yes, they were heathen. Yes, they were heathen. And we were not supposed to have much contact with them, especially at those moments when they were celebrating their festivals, because I think instinctively the Christians probably knew that these celebrations were more exciting than their own. Their rituals were more exciting, you see. There is a story that my great uncle, who was a very powerful man in the village when the Christians first came, and he was very open-minded about it, and he received them. He gave them a little corner of his compound to do their thing, you see. But later on, after he'd heard them singing, he said, "This is too sad. I mean, this sound is not good to be coming from a man's compound. So I'm afraid I'm going to ask them to move somewhere else." So the sound made by the Christian worship was not as exciting as the drumming and the dancing in the village arena. So I think one of the penalties you had to pay for being a Christian is to say, no, I turn my back to all that. And we as children were discouraged completely from going near. But there was also some ambivalence in this, because on other days when you are not having any critical events, my father's brother was still his brother. I mean, there was no separation. And if things happened which did not involve belief in God or anything. You know, they would behave like brothers.
Was there a turning point in your life where you had to decide when you came of age which culture you wanted to live in?
No, I always felt that the two belong to me.
See? Both of them?
Yes, both of them.
So you didn't have to choose one for the
other? No, but I had to make an effort to revalidate the traditional culture. I even had to learn about it because, you see, I grew up not knowing very much about it, even though it was going on around me, but there was this injunction on us not to pay too much attention.
So you were almost living in exile from your culture.
Yes. But you also had the possibility of sneaking out, you know, as children. We often did this, you know, my younger sister and I would sneak out and go and eat the food that our neighbors were cooking on their festivals, you know, just to see whether it tasted any different, as we were told, and it didn't, you know.
When you started reading and you wanted to read fiction that was set in your country, was it usually fiction written by English authors?
Yes. Yes, that was the revolution was gradual, but I think the key moment and this was the moment when perhaps the decision was taken instinctively that I must write. Was the moment I realized that those stories which I read, like Rider Haggard, like John Buchan's Prester John, those colonial novels in which the good white explorer or the good white missionary went and lived among the savages, you know, at great danger to himself, that these stories were not as simple or as innocent as I had assumed. As a child, you see, you automatically identified with the good people, with the missionaries, with the explorers, because that's the way the story was arranged. Now, the moment you realize that you were not really of the party of the white man, but of the party of the savages, the moment you realize that if you read The Heart of Darkness, you were not on that steamer with Marlowe and his crew, but you were one of those jumping on the shore. That's the moment when you knew that a new story had to be written.
And you wanted to write those stories.
Yes, and you had to write it.
My guest is novelist Chinua Achebe. Now, when writing those stories, I think traditionally the writer in Western cultures is somewhat outside of the culture, looking in, observing the culture from a distance, writing alone. Writers always describe writing as a very lonely existence. I think the role of the storyteller in African culture is one of being at the center of the society, where it's a much more social role than the writer's role, and a much more kind of part of like ongoing community life. Which did you see yourself as the storyteller, an integral part of the community, kind of passing on community history, or as that writer being somewhat outside of the culture looking at it, observing it at a distance?
Well, I think what has happened in the West is really a distortion of the real, of the proper role of the artist in society. Admittedly, there is need for a certain distancing, a certain standing back, a certain going away in order to think, moments for introspection and so on. But art is a public thing. Art which ceases to see itself as related to people for whom this art is made, I think is really failing and is almost doomed. And so it's really a matter of getting the right balance. I accept this need from time to time to move away, but I think that the basic function of art is a social thing, and the storyteller is there because there are people to tell stories to. Our ancestors created these stories in order to make our passage through the world easier, not more difficult.
You said at the beginning of the interview that you do think it's part of the writer's job to give headaches, not prescriptions. Have you given the governments of your countries the kind of headaches where they've tried to get you out of there or arrest you or punish you in any way?
Well, I've done my bit, yes, I've done my bit, and I go on doing it. I mean, there is this book, Ant Hills of the Savannah, I think is causing some people a lot of concern, and there's a lot of running around, and but nothing yet which I can complain about. No, the relationship between the emperor and the artist is a very, very tricky one, and one learns to live with it that way. You don't improve it by moving out and saying, "Oh no, I will move away from society and look in and talk only about general things like the condition of civilization." Because the emperor would be very happy for you to do that. It's when you are really dealing with things which relate immediately to the way society is managed that the emperor gets very, very mad at you. And so in that situation, you can expect all kinds of difficulties, depending on the emperor, depending on all kinds of things, depending on your own reputation, depending on your reputation with the people. So this is not something where you can be categorical.
We only have a few seconds left, but your new novel is set in a fictional country. Is that so as to not alienate too much to the emperor?
No, not that. I think what I'm trying to do there is to make it not just the story of one country, but the story of many countries.
Okay. I guess just have a couple of more seconds left. I want to thank you very much for joining us and for speaking with us. Will you be returning to Nigeria after being a visiting professor at the University of Massachusetts?
Yes, I'm going back at the end of this, in the summer this year. Yes, but I've had a good time, and thank you for asking me to come and talk here.
Thanks for being here. My guest has been Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe. His new book, Ant Hills of the Savannah, has recently been published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.